Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, eager to get your thoughts on the Clemson game, and we'll just have a little bit of a real intensive position-by-position preview of the Delaware State game. I know we'll jump right into that. Have a little bit of a question and answer period where we tried to grab four or five of the better questions that have been submitted to us recently. So excited to see what we have, and excited to do one of these as always, and want to start a podcast by thanking our sponsor, our title sponsor, Louisiana Hot Sauce. Three simple ingredients, one great product for us, one great partner for 2 years now, and couldn't be better paired with a product that you and I both thoroughly enjoy, authentically use, and as always, we want to thank them for allowing us to do podcasts like these.
Absolutely, man. Great sponsor for us, and a great product, and we absolutely love them, and we love y'all's support for them, too. Saw some good-looking chicken wings on the timeline this weekend with Louisiana Hot Sauce Incorporated. Speaking of questions, Bud, we've received several hundred already in November. So I'm going to lay out some guidelines real quick for how you can increase your chance to get your question read on the air, right? Number one, one paragraph or less. If you send us like an email that's like a book, we probably won't read that on the air because people don't like that. Also, that requires a lot of time. Number two, spell check and grammar. If we have to look like idiots trying to read this thing, that decreases their chance of actually reading it. Number three, make sure it's not something we've already addressed pretty thoroughly in the previous show. That is certainly a way to increase your chance of getting it read. And then number four, praise the sponsor. If your question also incorporates some sort of testimonial praising Louisiana Hot Sauce or Madison Social or Central or Township, then all those things can really help you get your question on the air or increase your chances of getting your question on the air.
I've got to say, like tonight, I grabbed five questions, could have grabbed 25. We've had some really good questions submitted recently, and we may not get to respond to all of them. We do read them. We certainly appreciate all of them, and just know that if we didn't get your question, it's not as though either of us dismissed it or didn't think it was worthy or anything else. We literally just, our inbox is full. Our mentions are frequent on social media, and it's tough to aggregate and put everything into one podcast.
I think we should probably start out. We'll do questions last, and we'll start out with our review of the Clemson game.
Absolutely, man. It was an interesting game, as I mentioned in the Instant Reaction podcast. A game when you and I spoke real briefly at halftime, I think both of us were pretty much on the verge of just writing off and not particularly expecting a whole lot more. There were certainly some periods of time where Florida State could have played better and could have really taken the lead there and put a whole lot of pressure on Clemson. But at the end of the day, when you look at it, and you look at the game in the entirety, it's probably a pretty fair result.
Yeah, I think that's kind of my great takeaway here was Clemson pretty thoroughly outplayed Florida State. Now, there were stretches in the game where Florida State outplayed Clemson, but there were many more stretches where Clemson outplayed Florida State. Like that first half, it counts. And Florida State just was not ready to play out the tunnel. They got dominated. On the day, 34% success rate for Florida State, 48% for Clemson. That's a really big margin when it comes to a success rate difference over the course of a whole game. And I think 17 points is honestly about accurate. Like people are like, the game was really closer than the score indicated. No, it wasn't. Clemson led by 17 at halftime. They led by 17 at the end of the game. Florida State had one good quarter. No. Clemson was a far better team, and the score indicated that. I'm not buying into this idea that Florida State was real close to winning that thing, because, to be honest, they weren't, I don't think.
Were they real close to winning that game? I don't know. Were they real close to putting pressure on a team that necessarily didn't give you all the evidence that they would have responded great to it? Maybe. But, really doesn't matter. I mean, if we're sitting here arguing back and forth as to how close Florida State could have come to maybe – not losing its sixth game of the year, I think kind of being short-sighted and foolish at that point.
You want to talk offense first?
Yeah, man. So the offensive game plan was, if you listen to our preview pod, it was fairly accurate. I mean, Florida State definitely took a lot of deep shots, knew that they didn't have a whole lot of chances for sustained drive, and had one real good chance in the first half, just wasn't able to connect, and for the most part, first half was one of the uglier offensive showings that I can remember.
Yeah, that was like throw up in your mouth bad. But we were right in some ways, and this is not like a pat on the back thing, right? It's not. I'm just we'd like to try and say, hey, were we right or were we wrong, and why? They did take a lot of those deep shots, and they just didn't hit very many of them. We were absolutely right that Florida State would not be able to do third long very well against Clemson. Oh, boy, were we right about that. Enger, 13% success rate on passing downs, which are downs of second and 7+ or third and 5+. 13%.
That is spectacularly poor.
That means your drive is dead when that happens. Just you're toast. Blackman was 3 of 13 for 34 yards in those situations. Yikes. I did like that they did hit their big plays for the most part. Four of their five bigger plays were in standard downs. So first down, second and six or less, third and five or fewer. That was good. But they just didn't have enough of those big plays. They needed more shots. And I'll credit Jimbo Fisher. I know a lot of people didn't like the play calling in the game, and certainly there's some things you can quibble with, but he did do a good job of designing, a lot of open shots, and unfortunately his quarterback just missed them. We'll talk about that in a second, certainly. I liked that they went hurry up and short yardage. That's the thing we mentioned on the podcast a couple weeks ago. I actually spoke to Tom Herman about that this summer when I was at a coaching clinic, and he said, look, I don't really believe you can trick people on the goal line. I believe in lining up as fast as you possibly can and being physical, and that your advantage comes hopefully from your physicality, but also from the defense just being misaligned because of your speed. Like, you're not going to trick them with plays. You might trick them with formation. Like, I know Texas will go unbalanced a lot, right, as fast as they can. Or I know Houston did that too. Actually, they did that at Florida State a couple times in the Peach Bowl because it takes the extra split second to realize, like, oh, shoot, this is not right. A tackle. It's a tight end. Right. So there's a strength to the opposite side, and you have to line, you have to shift over. And by that time, the offense might be snapping the ball. So all that kind of stuff. But I like that. They went short yardage up tempo a couple times. Hopefully that's something Florida State will continue to incorporate, because I really think that's something that can help them convert more third downs, which is a thing that they should do. They should convert more third downs, and I think that going like that really could help them. And in fact, on his coach's show, Fisher revealed that he liked that because Clemson couldn't get set with their goal line defense. And Ingram, you know what my thought was on that? What if?
I think I probably got an idea, but yeah, sure, please.
What if? Here's an idea. What if the defense couldn't get like super set and comfortable on non-goal line situations? It's a thought. Like, I got back from my softball game tonight, and when you step in the box, you put your hand back to the umpire, and he doesn't let the pitcher pitch until you're really dug in and you're set. I feel like sometimes the defenses are like Jimbo Fisher taking forever to call the play is like allowing that defense to get dug in exactly how they want to get and totally set up, I like the defense being uncomfortable. So I'm hoping that maybe at some point the light bulb will go off and be like, wait a second. If they can be uncomfortable and not set and prepared on the goal line, what about on like the 10-yard line? See what I'm saying? Anyway.
Or the 42. Yeah, we'll take it. Take it any way you can get it.
A couple things that I didn't like on the game planning. They did not do a good enough job of, like, when they had second and 10, they did not consistently enough get back to a third and, like, semi-manageable, right? They had 9 of their 15 third downs that they faced were third and 8+. So not only did they really do a terrible job in those long downs, but they had way too many of them. And I feel like part of that was maybe abandoning the run game a little bit. The other part was sort of beyond Fisher's control, and I don't want to, rag on him for this. His quarterback just kind of didn't take any checkdowns. And there were definitely some second down situations where the quarterback just didn't read the right thing, which I know we're going to talk about quarterback in probably 30 seconds here, but that was something that put them in a bad situation quite often.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, it was just not a whole lot of success to be had in general, regardless of down or distance or of anything else that you wanted to judge the offense by until you got a couple minutes into the third quarter, it seemed. But you mentioned it there. Why don't we go ahead and jump into Blackman, and didn't have his greatest game. And when you're as bad as Florida State was on offense in the first half, there's not going to be anybody that has any particularly pretty stats to show, but yeah, that was, we talked about games where your true freshman quarterback's just going to go and be a true freshman, and maybe that was it. Maybe that was it, because he was he was pretty ineffective in just about every way that you would like your quarterback to display either a mental awareness prior to the snap or just making a solid decision during the play that maybe allows you to not take a kill shot, or just making throws that were challenging, but, you know, by no means impossible either. There just wasn't a whole lot there that you were able to do in the first half at all.
Yeah, I think he really did have some jitters in this ball game, and man, he started 3 of 13 for 6 yards.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we talked about this. I mentioned a couple pivotal moments in previous games. I think he's, you know, look, he's a freshman. He's a true freshman, but I do think he's somebody that at times nerves get the best of him.
So that means he finished pretty strongly, right? They threw for, what, 250 or something, or 2-something on his final 20-something throw. So he's averaging about 10 yards per attempt, which is really strong after that start. But that start did bury you. You know, one thing, Ingram, we've seen with him a lot is that he doesn't always read the right side of I don't say the right side because people start thinking left and right. He doesn't always read the correct side of the field, which, to be honest, is like a freshman thing you can expect. Okay, he's not always going to diagnose the defense pre-snap correctly, especially if he doesn't have a whole lot of time to do it, you know, as we discussed. And you did a great job encapsulating that moment. And what a great job by the broadcast, you know,
to focus
on Fisher until he got the play called, which took way too long. And then he's, you know, he's b-ing out his quarterback. I know he was explaining today that he was just explaining to him or asking him why or something. Come on, man. Anyway, look, just because he says it doesn't mean we have to believe it. Anyway, so that kind of stuff to me, like not necessarily reading the correct side of the defense, is something that's expected. But I will say this game to me, there was a marked departure from his previous games in that he actually missed open guys pretty badly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were 4 or 5 or maybe even 6, depending on who you want to assign blame to. Because I know on his coach's show, Fisher blamed one of them on Nooney and one of them on Gavin. So maybe 4, maybe 6. Just open throws that would have been somewhere between like solid to huge plays that he just didn't hit and certainly had an opportunity to hit them. And that's not talking about throws that he didn't identify or didn't see. We're talking about like balls that just weren't on target. That's some DeAndre Francois type stuff. You know, the difference there is that Francois would have probably identified the right guy to throw it to more often. You know, on the final interception, Blackman just throws the ball to the wrong guy. Period. Like, he is one-on-one on the outside. The middle is double-covered. Instead, he throws to the middle instead of the matchup where you have Auden Tate, who's 6'6", on a 5'11", dude. One-on-one. That's pretty clearly his fault. So you are, and I'm not trying to speak negatively about the kid, right? We're not making, like, value judgments about him, and I do think he still has a very promising future. But the moment was too big for him too often in this game, and that's kind of what you're going to have sometimes when you have a true freshman quarterback. If he was a sophomore, I think, you know, maybe we pull the trigger and say, you know, maybe Florida State tries to pull this upset. But that was tough.
I agree. I mean, between what you said and some of the things that I said on the incident, I don't know that I have a whole lot more to say about Blackman. Still like a lot of his game. Still think he projects as a pretty good quarterback. Still think he has a lot of leadership characteristics that I think you need at that position. So I still am optimistic for him, but, you know, as I mentioned, he's a true freshman, and yes, he's the age that he is, but he's also started 8 games now, so he's got a better understanding as to what's expected of him and what he's going to see. So, interesting to see how much he can kind of pick up on that growth trajectory. He's got 2 pretty easy games out of 3 to end the year, and see where you are heading into what is hopefully a bowl game.
Absolutely, man. Running back, I guess?
Yeah, I don't think we'll have to spend a whole lot of time on running back here.
Because he only got 13 touches?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, look, I do have a little bit of a frustration that you couldn't run the ball a little bit better. Yes, your offensive line's dinged up. Yes, Clemson's really good. But Dexter Lawrence is probably the best of all of them. He wasn't playing. I don't know. Maybe I'm being too critical there. But to think that you just flat out couldn't get anything going in the running game is a little bit hard for me to wholeheartedly sign off on.
I think Cam Akers should have touched the ball more. There's something that Jeff Cameron brought up on his show today. He said, hey, do you think Fisher had that answer so ready about how they couldn't run the ball as much because they were down 3 scores? Do you think he had that ready because he realized he had screwed up? by not running a little more, not giving Cam Akers more touches. Yeah, I think that's very possible. You know, he did miss a cut that he should have cut the ball inside in the third quarter, but I think they scored on that drive anyway. 13 touches are disappointing, but I'm still really high on Cam Akers. That's kind of all I got to say about running back. I mean, I think he might have missed one pass protection.
Yeah. Jacquez Patrick came back, didn't get injured. That's a plus in my book. We'll go from there. Bud, wide receiver. Keith Gavin also made his way back, had 1 to 2 kind of rough routes, had a, I guess I'd call that a drop. And interestingly enough, was returning kickoffs. I don't want to spend a ton of time just constantly questioning coaches, but that, man, that is really hard for me to make sense of. When we're telling Ermon Lane to go play a different position every other week, and you've got a kid who's not particularly good at doing that, back there doing the same thing that got himself injured. I don't know. Again, maybe I'm being wordy, but some things that we're doing that I'm just very questioned as to what the real thought process behind that.
Hopefully they'll have a new coach next year for receivers. Did you catch that, by the way? People over the weekend were mad. They were claiming that we were giving opposing teams information to recruit against Florida State.
I promise you, nobody has to listen to either of our dumbasses to negatively recruit Florida State right now.
No, they can just have Google. They can see that Lawrence Dossey has produced 2 receiver draft picks in 10 drafts, and it's about to be 10 and 11. All they need is Google. They don't need us. They're not idiots. I wrote about that today on Tomahawk Nation. So anyway, Nooney had a bad route or two that Fisher called out on the show, and it was good to see Tate back out there. But, you know, those guys, I thought they did a decent job of getting open a decent bit of the time, and yet, you know, Blackman didn't hit them, and then sometimes when Blackman was throwing at them, they didn't come down with it. So not great syncing up there.
Tight end, obviously the play that's going to stand out is the double back power or the double flea flicker that Izzo makes a nice play. Also, Tate does a good job of getting down and looks to make one pretty nice block and then kind of runs interference on the second one. So solid effort there by Tate, and good for Izzo to make the most of a moment and find a way to get in the end zone there.
O-line, I guess we need to talk about. I know Clemson's front's really, really good, but I thought they had a lack of physicality in the run game. You know, just not manning up enough, and that kind of does lead me to question the strength and conditioning program a lot. We know we've heard complaints that this strength and conditioning program kind of makes the freaks freakier, but may not raise the floor enough. And this is a complaint we've heard from some coaches on the staff and former coaches. So if that's the case, you know, you kind of wonder, okay, maybe they need something that raises the collective floor a little bit and doesn't make the freaks freakier. That's kind of more of an off-season discussion, I think. But Florida State's offensive linemen, some of them didn't look like they belonged on the field against Clemson's defensive line. And it wasn't entirely surprising that they got whipped at times, because that's the best defensive line in the country. And they do that to almost everybody they play, including, you know, I mean, Auburn just put, what, 45 up on Georgia? And they had, I think, 2 third down conversions against Clemson or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and Stidham was sacked 9 times. So it's not like Clemson doesn't do that. They do that to people. But you know, more physicality was needed in a run game. They got to get tougher. They got to get more physical. And that's not a zone-blocking, man-blocking, you know, gap scheme zone. It's not that. It's just a mentality and a strength conditioning thing as well. So that's that was concerning. And then also I thought that the pass protection, this is where I think I differ with a lot of people that emailed us. I thought the pass protection was better than a lot of the emailers thought, and I thought the run blocking was worse. On one of the sacks, it's Nooney's fault. Blackman looks for him on a play where he has to get rid of the ball, and Nooney runs the wrong route. And on another one, Blackman didn't see the blitzer. Well, that's on him. And I think 2 of them were on the offensive line, and I think 1 was on a back.
I'll also say Blackman doesn't, you know, a lot of things he can work on, but he doesn't do his offensive line any favors as far as stepping up in the pocket when it's appropriate, maybe not walking right into defensive linemen when he does try to do it. And look, he's a big, tall, lanky guy. I'm not expecting some wildly fluid athlete, but he just does seem to kind of walk himself into a lot of trouble or not, you know, step into an area of the pocket where you do have some room to operate there. So, I thought as far as pass protection, the offensive line had a pretty good day on the whole, just wasn't really complimented by some of the supporting pieces around them.
This offense is just so hard to watch, man. It's just so hard to watch. You know, but he does take forever to get rid of the ball. You know, and it's tough. They also don't really threaten the defense with his legs at all. You know, and that allows defenses to pin their ears back. I'll run down the playoff teams this year real quick. This is not on our list, but tell me which playoff teams you think throw the ball well. Clemson.
No.
Alabama.
Not particularly, no.
Miami.
Probably better than the first two, but no, not a real threat to throw the ball all over the yard.
Wisconsin.
No. I'll go ahead and say Georgia, no.
Nobody out west. Potentially Auburn.
Better than the other teams.
Instead of getting better. Yeah. But, I mean, still they get 9 sacks to Clemson. Ohio State, I guess, still has some very outside shot to get in. Kind of, not really, I guess. Oklahoma, yes, for sure. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of these teams that we just named off that are elite teams, and I do think college ball is down this year, by the way, like across the board. And I was talking to Bill Connolly about this, and he said, yeah, I think this year's Bama team, which is number 2 in his rankings, would be number 7 if they were last year.
Hmm.
Timing matters when you're good. That's kind of a Mark Richt lesson as well, which, you know, a lot of times he's had his best teams in years where they're just another great team. But my general point before I got sidetracked off the sidetrack was a lot of these teams are succeeding without being able to throw the ball, but they're doing it because they actually run their quarterbacks. I brought this up today in the comment section. I said, look, I think the ceiling of Jimbo Fisher's offense is as high as anybody's, right? We've seen it. Mm-hmm. It's the highest scoring team in college football history. But I do think the floor is lower than a lot of these other offenses. And the reason I believe that is because it's a lot easier for me to go get a kid who's a decent passer and a strong runner than it is for me to find a good pocket passer. I'm telling you this, folks, I do this for a living. I'm out there at all these camps. These guys are not easy to find, especially not when they're young. And this is what you're seeing. I think it's much easier. You know, if you put Blackman in a lot of other offenses, I think he would be doing a lot better than he is now. You can tell me he's skinny, and that's fine. But how many shots did he take on Saturday in the pocket that he could have taken different shots or more glancing blows or shots he could actually run out of bounds if you actually run him? But no, Jimbo Fisher's too good for that. He speaks down about that. Listen to his tone of his voice. It carries such a tone of disdain when he talks about these spread offenses that run their quarterbacks. Man, the world is changing around him very rapidly. Carson Wentz, Deshaun Watson, Jared Goff. This thing where, you know, okay, I've sent 4 guys to the NFL in the first round. You can't take that away from him. But what you can take away from him is this idea that these other offenses won't produce NFL quarterbacks. Because the NFL is now adapting to the spread. It's not the other way around. Mm-hmm. They're not forcing the kids to adapt to them. They're coming to the spread teams. And that drastically reduces Jimbo Fisher's advantage. Deshaun Watson is hurting Florida State in quarterback recruiting. Jared Goff is hurting Florida State in quarterback recruiting. He came from the air raid. Well, guess what? Grant Gunnell is committed to an air raid team at Texas A&M. Trevor Lawrence is committed to something that some coach who may or may not be on Florida State has referred to as a, you know, a Mickey Mouse offense before. He's committed to Clemson. Those NFL teams are now kind of coming to the spread teams. This is hurting Florida State. I've got an article coming out about this, by the way. This is hurting their quarterback recruiting. And I do think that if Fisher doesn't change, and unless he gets another Jameis, it's hard for me to believe that he's going to have that offense back on top like that. I do think he's a good offensive coach, though. It's just, it doesn't need to be a huge philosophical change. Just, you know, some important changes, and that's kind of all I wanted to say there. Did you mention that Kelly wasn't right, by the way, Derek Kelly?
No, I didn't.
Because that was pretty obvious to me.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious, and he's
he didn't practice all week.
Man, I really like Derek Kelly. I mean, I know that's going to make him feel real pleased that some random podcaster likes his attitude, but he seems to be one of the only offensive linemen that cares, that gives a damn about not having his quarterback strung out in a lifeless manner on the ground, and you can tell that kid's trying to give you everything that he can, and he just doesn't have a whole lot to provide right now.
I mean, I feel bad, but that's exactly right. Let's talk defense. The one thing that we said was, well, we said 2 things. Number 1, we said Clemson really didn't hit very many explosive plays, right, going into the game, and that they like to grind out drives. And one way they do that is that they stay ahead of the chains. So what Florida State had to do is they had to win first down. Ingram, Clemson was 10 of 17 on third downs. You know that 11 of their 17 third down attempts were 5 yards or fewer?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, we can talk about how this defense did a good job. And for a lot of the game, they did a solid job. But, man, they didn't stop the run on first and second down well enough. They gave up 54% rushing success rate. That is egregiously bad. They didn't make Clemson uncomfortable, really, at any time defensively. Clemson did some boneheaded stuff, but it was kind of more self-inflicted a lot of times. They did not stop the run and force Clemson into obvious passing downs, nearly enough. And that's why Clemson was able to operate comfortably. They ran for 200 yards. I mean, the defense faced 85 snaps. I know a lot of that is actually on FSU because FSU just couldn't hold on to the ball for long enough stretches. But, man, 54% rushing success rate is not going to get it done. That's pretty poor.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, and there's no way to argue with that. I would just say that from watching that game, probably the only unit that really stood out to you was the defensive line.
Oh, I thought the D-line played well.
And obviously the defensive line is not the only people that are responsible for run, but thought Naughty and Christmas played, again, really, really well. Naughty might have had the best game he's had all year. And for a guy who's probably been your best player all year, that's a statement. Defensive ends, Josh Sweat continues to play at a really high level. Burns obviously had his best game probably ever as a Seminole, as Florida's impactful plays that he made. So if you look at that game and you think the defensive line played well and you had trouble with run stops, you kind of naturally move to the linebackers there. And I wasn't particularly blown away by the game that they had when I recorded the Instant Reaction podcast, and then going back and look at it, I'm probably even a little more critical of some of the things they did.
They could get rid of Bill Miller yesterday, and I don't think it would improve it. I mean, I don't think it would hurt a damn thing. Those linebackers are so disappointing. I'm not going to say they're terrible, because they're not terrible, but they're just not – they don't play up to their potential.
Mm-hmm.
I think the D-line played pretty well. The only thing I'll quibble with the D-line a little bit is that they gave up too many scrambles. Kelly Bryant's not a good thrower.
Yeah.
He looks to scramble, and they got out of their rush lanes too often. I mean, Brian Burns forced 2 sacks, but he was also undisciplined several times and gave up big rushes.
It's just a little thing, single plays. And look, when you're 3-6, we're not going to go spend a whole lot of time on single plays. But one of the first series of the games, Bud, we stunt. And I think it's, yeah, so we bring Sweat on the inside and have Naughty loop back out. Well, what that means is that you've got Derek Naughty basically trying to play contain on Kelly Bryant. Doesn't do it. Bryant gets outside. He doesn't pick up a first down or anything. But even some of the small little things that we do don't always make sense to me with what we're trying to do, particularly where we're trying to limit a quarterback's ability to scramble or make plays with his legs. So even just when you made that comment, there's some things that I saw us do that I kind of scratched my head and wasn't sure exactly the thought process.
We have a question, and we're not going to get to questions till the end, but I kind of want to take – can we take question number two now?
Question reads, how much of the defense's struggles can be attributed to Charles Kelly not being able to run the defense Jimbo wants? In other words, is Charles Kelly having trouble teaching this defense? Is pattern matching challenging to teach players? Sometimes it's not what you know, but how well you can teach it.
That's from a Noel fan in North Dakota. Oh, cool. Got a listener in North Dakota, man. And I want to bring this up now because, look, the answer to it is yes. They are definitely struggling to teach the defense that Jimbo wants to run. The defense that, as far as I know, Kelly knows how to run, but is not able to impart the knowledge effectively enough to the defense, which is his job to coordinate the defense, and it's not really well coordinated. For instance, I watched part of the game with a defensive coordinator on Saturday before you do the instant, because I had to go to the IMG Academy, and we were chatting, and he's like, it's really crazy to me how Florida State claims to play pattern match defense, and yet they just drop to spots and don't slide or pass off guys or communicate at all.
Right.
I was like, yeah, it's been happening for like 20 games. So, like, it's pretty clear they've just given up to me. Or they have to have given up. I don't get to watch practice intimately, so I hear what goes on, but not generally like, oh, hey, they totally stopped teaching pattern match. They just... I have to assume they stopped teaching pattern match because they just don't do it in games. Nobody is matching patterns out there. They're not, you know, you watch and you're like, man, why is there so much space in the middle of our defense? Why does it feel like the safeties and linebackers are never in the right spot, especially communicating with each other over the middle? Well, that's the reason. They just drop to spots and then react from there, as opposed to when you're playing pattern match, you're essentially playing man-to-man principles within a zone defense. That 2013 team played a pretty good amount of match and did it really well. You know, Stoops did some match stuff. And in fact, in 2015, I thought Florida State played a pretty decent match. But for whatever reason, last 2 years, they've not done it real well. And you can bet Jimbo's trying to get back to that. And everybody, pretty much everybody, plays some form of match. Now, there's different kind of matches, and I don't want to get into that on podcasts. I need a whiteboard to show this. But if you don't do any kind of match effectively, you're going to get your ass torn up by teams over the middle of your defense because they know either you're playing man-to-man or you're playing zone. And they look different if you're not playing match. They look a lot different because the backers are just dropping to spots. And that's what Florida State does, and that's why Clemson's able to just, you know, hit them over the middle on the very few pass attempts that they actually did have. So, yeah, pattern match can be challenging to teach the players, but you got to be able to do it. You don't get paid $900,000 for something simple, right? I won't forget this. There's an NFL D tackle this summer at a summer camp I was at, and he had a Super Bowl ring on or conference championship ring or whatever, and he was talking to this kid said, hey, you know, this stance isn't comfortable. He's like, I don't get paid millions of dollars to be comfortable. Nobody's going to give you millions and money and fame and stuff to be comfortable. You get paid to be uncomfortable. I mean, that is so true. So yeah, that's a problem for Florida State's defense. Also, their run fits were garbage several times. This is why you give up runs when your defensive line's playing well, because your backers and safeties aren't fitting it. On that one long touchdown run, Hoskins has to spill that ball. They got an unblocked safety. Instead, where does he go? Well, the ball goes to the wrong side. Touchdown.
Mm-hmm.
Senior, fifth-year senior, doing that kind of stuff. That's another reason why you got to fire this defensive staff. I like the defensive backs. I thought they covered well almost the whole day. At least one, if not both, the pass interference penalties to me were kind of just fluky. And, you know, one was definitely the cause of the throw being so bad that the receiver basically ran into the DB because he was reacting to a ball that was just that far off target.
Mm-hmm.
Can't complain about how they played for the most part. Brian only had 150 yards passing. They seemed to tackle all right on the outside. Linebackers where this defense got victimized on Saturday.
A lot of changes to be made on both sides of the ball, but obviously the defense is the one that you have the biggest chance to see a sweeping change in philosophy and hopefully mentality as well. We're just, look, we've been saying this since the second game of the year. We are way too talented to be this freaking passive on defense. So be nice to see what the future holds and what kind of changes you're actually going to see from this unit. Bud, we'll jump down to take a question here. We'll jump back up. Defensive back, she said, yep, I was pretty impressed on the day. Stanford Samuels continues to progress. Really unfortunate penalty that he got with the 15-yard either face mask or hands to the face or whatever on Hunter Renfro. Thought Derwin James probably had his best game of the year. It's really good to see him be as active as he was. Starting to see Derwin play, you know, I don't know if he's playing like best player in college football level, but you're really starting to see Derwin play at a high level and be an impactful player in the past two games.
Dude, I'm really impressed. And you know, for the NFL, I think that'll be great too, man. Like, he really just played his ass off, and I like where the young guys are coming up, and I there's going to be some talent there to work with. I know Derwin's going to be gone, and T-Mac will be gone, but the secondary is not where I'm worried about for next year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, defensively, I do think there's going to be a drop-off almost regardless of coach, but it doesn't have to be a big one. You know, I they do lose a lot, but you get Hamsa, Taylor, Samuels, Becker, who I think is a guy who could seriously benefit from a change of direction back there.
Definitely.
Westbrook, who I feel like is a dude with good coaching. Like, Westbrook's not an athletic freak, right? But he doesn't have to suck.
Mm-hmm.
He's a guy, he's a coach's kid. He's a guy who should get the game if it's being taught well to him and can be an important piece on a defense. Not like a superstar, but like a nice role player. You know, like maybe like Nate Andrews with range, you know,
mm-hmm.
could be Westbrook potentially, or some range that, you know, like you're losing what you lose Marshall, you lose James, you lose McFadden, and you lose Andrews, who doesn't really play anymore. I think that's all right. I mean, look, that's going to hurt. There's no doubt. they're having to use Derwin to plug so many different holes this year. It's like that cartoon where the guy's just trying to put his finger in all the different leaks in the dam. But if you get better coaching and there's a few, fewer leaks to plug, then, you could still have a really good unit. But they got to wipe the staff. This is
Hard to watch. And look, I'm not trying to water down losing Derwin James, but man, Marshall has regressed significantly, in my opinion, and really he's become almost a liability unless you have him playing closer to line and providing run support. So
he can't cover.
Can't do a whole lot for you right now. So yeah, you're losing some pieces, but I think with a little bit better coaching, a little bit better instruction, that secondary could very easily be a real strength for you next year.
All right, let's talk special teams real quickly here. I thought the kick coverage was very good. I thought the punt coverage and the punting on the day was kind of eh. Although Tyler hit the crap out of that one.
He killed it.
60 yards from his own end zone.
Murdered it.
But you got two guys out of their rush lanes. So it ended up being a big time return. I thought punt return was really strong. And I tweeted this during the game. I said, look, this is the example of the process being broken. I don't care how good a guy or how well a guy returns punts in practice when it's non-contact. If he's worried about his NFL future and he gets out there in the game and looks like he's scared to catch punts like McFadden looked for a lot of this year, well, guess what? The practice part becomes irrelevant because the situation has changed. You are not accurately simulating the game situation in practice because the game is live and practice is not. So put somebody else in there. It shouldn't take 8 games to do that, which unfortunately did. And look, did you like him returning punts? I thought DJ looked really good back there.
Man, second time DJ touched a ball on punt return, it was wildly obvious. I'm not talking about this game. I mean, in past things, it was just he's a natural at it. It was real close to he had that one return where he ran a whole hell of a lot. I don't know that he maybe got more than 12 or 13 yards up the field, but you got a real good idea as to what's possible there. And also, I would say a little bit of a complaint in my head as to why we can't get that kid with the ball in space on offense, but that's a digression that I don't want to do 45 minutes deep into a pod.
No, but I do want to digress into this. All the people are like, oh, you guys said Lamonte Taylor would be good at punt return. You guys said DJ Matthews. I only said that because I saw them just make people look stupid foolish in high school and in like the high school all-star games and have seen him catch many punts in my time and look a lot better and a lot more natural at it and willing at it than McFadden was. And I'm not trying to bag on McFadden here, right? It's a lost season. If he's protecting himself for the league, it's hard to blame him. All y'all should direct all those questions about punt return to Jimbo Fisher, because I'm not convinced I'm wrong about Lavonte Taylor or about DJ. I don't care if Taylor or if McFadden was a little bit better than them in practice. It's very clear that in the game, DJ's a lot better. So I'm not willing to accept that I was wrong about that now, actually. I think that we could reopen that issue as to whether Lavonte and DJ might actually be better options. I think DJ's already proven to be so. Ingram, Delaware State is the opponent this week. Before we get to questions, I want to quiz you here on some important Delaware State content.
Yeah, please. I mean, I'll go ahead and tell you that you'll be probably pretty disappointed in my lack of knowledge, but I welcome the questions.
All right. Are you familiar with the Jeff Sagarin ratings?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Here is the...
from back in the day. Wasn't he a pretty big component of like the BCS rankings or something like that way back 10, 15 years ago?
Correct. He has Florida State 34th nationally right now.
Okay. I like that guy.
He ranks... okay. I mean, that's... they are by far the best 3-16 in the nation.
Well, we got that going for us. Good.
By a lot. Purdue is the next closest 6-loss team, and they're down at 46. The next closest 3-win team is Florida at 69th. Do you want to take a guess where Delaware State ranks? And look, Jeff is a guy that actually ranks FCS and FBS together, because there are certainly some FCS teams that are better than FBS teams.
What's my pool to choose from here, number-wise?
There are 254 schools.
I'm going to guess that they're in the bottom 20, so 235 and below.
That's a hell of a guess, actually. They are 247. Dude, not only did Florida State schedule an FCS team, they scheduled
So this is like Savannah State.
It might be worse.
Might be worse.
Legitimately. Okay. I'm not joking about this. Like, you might have a running clock on Saturday. Which I'm all for.
I was going to say, cool. I don't think that's going to hurt anybody's feelings at this point. But
yeah, Delaware State, can you name a team rated below Delaware State? There are only seven of them.
If one of them's not Savannah State, I don't think I have a chance.
No, Savannah State's 237. Delaware State's 247.
Okay. All right. Apologies to the people in Southeast Georgia there. I have no idea. Who are these 10 teams?
All right. Let's name them here. We have Marist.
Okay. More familiar Texas with the high school than I am the college, but all right.
Texas Southern. Arkansas Pine Bluff, which actually for a while had the national record for consecutive losses.
Didn't they lose like 6 years in a row or something like that? I remember that.
Yeah, not six losing seasons, but like seasons in a row without a win.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stetson.
Okay.
Y'all, okay, then this is important because our Florida listeners will understand this. Delaware State is ranked only four spots ahead of Stetson. Think about that. Morehead State, Mississippi Valley State, and then Davidson.
Oh.
And Davidson's rating is a 3.7, which, for instance, Delaware State's rated an 18. Davidson's like power rating is a 3.74. That is
strong.
Wow.
Strong. Must be diverting all those resources into the basketball program.
I'm thinking so. So Delaware State did get a win last week. They beat Morgan State by 3 at home, but they lost to Savannah State by 2 touchdowns.
Mm.
North Carolina Central beat them 42-14. Howard beat them 52-23. West Virginia beat this Delaware State team by 54 points. Oh, wow. Okay. Missouri beat Delaware State 79-0.
Okay.
Ingram, it was 58-0 after the first 25 minutes.
Got us a real squad going up against this week. All right.
Yeah, so like if you're asking are they worse than that Savannah State team? I think there's a legitimate chance that they are. Yeah. Also, damn. You know how Missouri was having like little issues in the early part of the season?
Mhm.
They let that quarterback just air it out. Drew Locke, Missouri starter, is actually pretty good. They let him chuck it 36 times. Gets Delaware State.
Gotta get a little confidence in the lad. Let him
400 yards and 5 touchdowns.
Exactly.
That's awesome. So, Delaware State is terrible, and for that reason, we will have a special episode on Thursday or Friday, but we will not be previewing Delaware State.
Yeah, what you just got was your Delaware State preview pod, by the way. That was the last 4.5 minutes. So,
legitimate chance this is the worst team Florida State's ever played in the history of the program.
And we'll do our defensive coordinator hot board. We'll be sliding names up and down the board throughout the pod. Given an idea. It's a fluid situation.
Can we have Judson make, you know that song, the Hot Boy song?
Yes.
Judson, can you alter that to and insert the word board instead of boy?
Yes.
For our show? Because that could be strong.
Speaking of strong, bud, let's get to these questions here.
Let's do it, man.
Question one. Which would have a more significant impact on Florida State recruiting? Miami or Clemson making the playoff and or winning the ACC title this year?
Miami, I think pretty clearly.
Yeah.
Like, Miami's closer to you. They're closer to the talent. Clemson is already an elite program. Right. Miami is not.
I was going to say, Clemson can already make that argument. I mean, them winning an ACC isn't going to convince kids that they're playing at any higher of a level than the team that won the national championship last year. So, on this one, I think we've got a pretty clear answer.
We already answered question number two. Number three, fellas, great job on this pod. Easily the best FSU-related pod available. I agree. In terms of the DC position at Florida State, please give me your thoughts on Derek Ansley and Corey Raymond. We will have to. Derek Ansley is the DB coach at Alabama. Corey Raymond is the DB coach at LSU. Do you think that Ansley's ready for a DC job in the limelight? Do you think there would be any possible way that Jimbo could pry Raymond away from Baton Rouge? Lastly, if Jimbo flips the script, is it okay with a defensive play caller who doesn't call the D from the back end and hires a DC who is a linebacker coach? What are your thoughts on Corey Bell as a potential DB coach? I think he's a damn good coach and elite recruiter who could get some momentum back in South Florida. With the new regime coming to Gainesville, you have to think that he will be available, and with Lawing recently proving that you can go from UF to FSU as a position coach, although maybe not super successfully in year two, this has to be an intriguing possibility. So I'll take the second part of this first. I don't think the guy will be a linebacker coach because I think Fisher has a pretty stated preference for wanting to call this thing back to front and that it'll be a DB coach by trade. But I like all those names, certainly. I mean, Corey Raymond, I don't know if he has any experience calling a defense or if he comes from the Saban tree enough, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a hell of a recruiter, and LSU's defensive backs play pretty well. But I don't know why he would leave LSU for Florida State unless it's to be a DC. Ansley certainly is a name we'll discuss on Thursday's show. That's called a teaser. And I've already mentioned Corey Bell. I think on a previous show, I like Corey Bell a lot. And I think the kids on that team in Gainesville like working for him. And Florida's DBs, at least coverage-wise, sure play a hell of a lot better than Florida State's do. They just don't stop the run. Which, by the way, it's that time. Let's play our favorite game here. Florida's run defense.
I almost stole this from you on the instant reaction pod, and I thought that just wouldn't. I know how much joy you get out of this,
but you don't have the spreadsheet to update the new season totals.
Didn't have the spread, but I had an idea as to where they were, and I was able to watch the South Carolina game play out. So I had some ideas. I had some ideas
for our new listeners. We play this. And I'm glad you didn't steal this. I do enjoy doing this segment. We play this game every week. We look at how opposing running backs, so not quarterbacks or receivers or anything like that, just the running backs, how they did against Florida's run defense because of a trend that we noticed in the first four games of the season, which was that all their opponents were just ripping them with the run game. So, Ingram, do you think their average this week went up or down?
I think their average might have gone, just from what I remember from that game, I think they might have gone slightly down.
No, they actually went slightly up.
Ooh. Probably not Florida taking into account enough quarterback runs there, actually.
I think, well, because this is only running backs.
Okay, this isn't a yard. Okay, right.
Now, they did have that weird thing where there was like an interception that was fumbled, and then a running back picked it up and ran with it for 20 yards.
One of the most amazing plays I've ever seen live. It was
very
it was
Florida.
Incredible. It was. I was like, ooh, yep, that's going to happen. Okay, he picked it up. Oh, this kid might take it to the house. No, but yeah, it was. It had Florida 2017 written all over it.
So, South Carolina running backs touched the ball 35 rushes for a .198 on the ground, which comes out to 5.7 per carry, and that increased UF's season total from 5.2 average allowed to 5.3. So, on the year, running backs, 265 carries, 1,415 yards. That's an average of 5.3. If you were a stud running back and you could play Florida's defense every week, you would almost certainly win the Heisman.
Yeah, you would. Have quite the historical year doing it, too.
Yeah. I think about this. So they've only played 9 games. They're on pace to, if they played 12, they would be on pace to allow about 1,890 yards to opposing running. What year did Ingram win the Heisman? 09?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that year, Mark Ingram had 271 carries, 1,658 yards, and 17 touchdowns. Florida's defense is very close to Heisman allowed status to opposing running backs.
Can't wait, man. Like I said a couple episodes ago, Florida's about the only thing that's helping me keep my sanity this year. So
I tweeted it, by the way, from the Tomahawk Nation account, and somebody tweeted back, very much look forward to Jimbo throwing the ball 48 times. Which, you know.
Yeah. Saw some things. Wanted to throw it around a little bit. Question 5. Love the pod. In the last episode, y'all spoke about Fisher wanting facilities and him possibly trying to leverage the A&M rumors again. Instead of telling him to pound sand, how about Florida State promises him the facilities if he agrees to lower the buyout by however much Florida State gives out for the facilities? Possibly a way for FSU to get out of this horrible deal. Doubt Fisher would do it, but at least would show how serious he is about the facility nonsense.
You want to role play this? You can be athletic director Stan Wilcox, and I will be Fisher's agent, Jimmy Sexton.
Yeah, I have a feeling this would be a real short conversation, but Jimmy, we were
what's going on?
We were interested in maybe putting a real enticing package on the table and see if maybe you'd be willing to reevaluate the current contract that we have.
Well, I got to hold on. Let me get you on the speakerphone here on my private jet. Okay, go.
All right, we're looking to give your client some of the institutional support that he's asked for, and we're just looking to see if maybe we could meet in the middle somewhere. And by that, I mean that we want to put a significant amount of money into the facilities that he's wanted. But we're looking at maybe he and you meeting us in the middle by reducing that buyout a little bit. Maybe not dollar for dollar, but how about 50 cents on the dollar? For every dollar we put into facilities, the buyout gets reduced by half. Half a dollar, that is.
Like an offset or something?
Just a show of good faith that we're willing to put the money where coaches want it.
You know, I certainly am appreciative of Florida State putting the money in facilities, but I got to ask you, if that buyout gets reduced and y'all decide to make a change, does he have any equity in those facilities that he can cash in?
Not something we had planned on putting forward.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, I think that a truly elite program would just raise that money, and we'll go ahead and keep our guaranteed $40 million, whether or not we win another game over the next 8 years. Pretty sweet deal.
All right, Jimmy. Well, enjoy your plane, and I appreciate you listening to this offer.
All right, Stan, good luck for basketball season. Oh, okay. So I talked to Houston Griffith, the DB recruit, the four-star, at the IMG game. And he was not super forthcoming with answers. He hit me with, I am currently committed to Florida State.
It's always good to hear. It's always good
currently.
To hear.
Currently. And I was like, I know. I was like, so where does Notre Dame fit in this picture? Because your Twitter account tweeted a graphic that was very professionally done of you saying 4 for 40, which is Notre Dame's slogan, like a four-year decision turns into a 40-year you know, good decision because the whole career and alumni base and networking, all that crap. What happened there? He's like, oh, my teammates grabbed my phone. Like, we like to joke around a lot, which I know can be true. I don't know if it's true in this case. Even so.
Did they slop a Photoshop together real quickly on the fly?
Okay, and that was my question. Like, okay, so maybe they did grab your phone, but then they found that you happen to have very professionally done Notre Dame commitment graphic right there to tweet. So something smells there. I'm not saying Florida State's 100% going to lose him. I did ask him if they were to make a move and change defensive coordinators or DB coaches, would that affect you? And he said, no, I commit to the school and not to the coach. You know, maybe he's a kid who's been told something. I don't know. But I certainly think he's worth watching. Notre Dame is very close to his home of Chicago, which is where he's from before he moved down, you know, for his last 2 years at IMG. So anyway, I figured I'd provide that. And I also did a big time recruiting update on Tomahawk Nation today. It's about 2,000 words. Y'all can check that out. It just kind of goes into some stuff. And well, I think you guys should read it. It's long, and I'm probably not going to be able to summarize it all here on the podcast.
Yeah, it's a good article. I read it. I enjoyed it. I know a couple other people picked it up and distributed it. It's a good read, bud, and it's a good kind of honest assessment as to where this class is and what it might look like come the first and second signing period. So would encourage everybody to go take a look at that. I know that's on Tomahawk currently.
Reviews are important. We got a lot of new 5-star reviews. You know, Ingram, I think we have 900 5-star reviews now on iTunes. That's pretty awesome.
That is incredible. Yeah, it really is.
No, we don't. 894. We are inches away,
inches.
Literally inches away from inches from having 900 5-star reviews. That's pretty cool that many people would take their time to go review us 5 stars. It'd be even cooler if 106 more of y'all did, because then we'd have an even 1,000.
Yeah,
and that'd be great.
If we could get 1,000 by the new year, that'd be awesome. So maybe 1,000 by Jan 1. That's probably an ambitious goal, but be great for us to have, and certainly be appreciated if you guys can find the time to leave us a review. And it's just, as I say frequently, it's kind of ridiculous that those things are as important as they are, but no use in arguing with the system. As you said in that article that I just referenced a second ago, there comes a time where perception matters so much that it almost forces itself into reality, and those reviews are kind of a small, strange example of that. So we'll just want to thank everybody that's taken the time to do that, and if you could be one of the 106 people to do so that hasn't, I would appreciate it even more.
You know, one other thing about reviews I'll say, for whatever reason, like some people, you're familiar with the website Yelp?
Yeah, very.
It's like a review website, right? I don't really use Yelp a whole lot. But like Matt, Matt who runs Matt's social will tweet and showing just like total just jerk reviews that people leave, for no reason or for things that like are totally outside of a restaurant's control. You know, like the table next to me, was rude, stuff like that. These reviews like hurt local businesses when you leave bad reviews like that. So what I'm asking is don't go leave a review if you haven't been there. But if you've been there and you enjoyed it, I mean, we get a lot of really good feedback on email. People say, hey, I appreciate the recommendation. Madison Social was great, or Township or Centralia were awesome. If you do that, certainly go on and say, hey, I heard about it on the Nolcast, and I enjoyed it, and here was my experience. Because let's drown out the nonsense. I mean, just like any small business, if there's a legitimate criticism, they want to improve. But if it's just nonsense, it drags down the rating. That sucks. Nobody likes that. So go help out our sponsors in that way if you've happened to hit up any of their fine establishments.
Just the idea of Yelp is a really good one. So easy to, particularly a new business, really easy to put an unearned burden on them. And zeros don't average well, and it's tough to catch up. One thing that I'm pretty damn confident anybody with half a mind who experiences won't be slapping out any 0 or 1 stars to anybody is if you make your way over to Madison Social on the 17th, which is, Thursday of this week? Friday of this week? Friday and Reuben Day at Madso, tough combination. Tough combination to beat. The Reuben is one thing that we've been singing the praises of since day one. It is, honestly, it's a world-class sandwich. It's fantastic. They only do it once a month. Can't stress enough that if you get the opportunity, swing by, enjoy it, and experience one of the better culinary things that you're going to encounter in Tallahassee. All right, bud. I think this is a pretty good stopping point for this episode. Probably the last time that we'll really do a kind of a position-by-position review, at least until the Florida game. But it's good to kind of look back and have an idea as to what you really saw on Saturday. And I think at this point we've all become kind of conditioned to losses, and maybe not quite as angry or upset as we were earlier in the year, but just another disappointing day in a season that's been full of letdowns. So we'll move on, hopefully win the next 3 games, and be talking about a program that prepares for some kind of hilariously embarrassing bowl game. Although, actually, if Florida State gets bowl eligible, just the name and fan base and cachet alone will probably get them into a bowl game that maybe they're not particularly deserving of. Who knows? That might even be a conversation for a later pod.
Oh, Ingram, I do have to mention one other thing here real quick. We will do a positional preview or review for Delaware State, Florida State, if Florida State loses, because the spread just came out as we were talking.
It'll be a solo pod, but I'll tell you
that
much.
You want to take a guess what this is?
You guys might not hear from me for about 2 or 3 months if we lose to Delaware State. Seriously.
Well,
you're more likely to read about me in a newspaper article than you are hear my voice on a podcast.
I got to tell you, Ingram, that would be the largest upset in college ball history. Do you know what the spread is?
I have no idea. So let me guess here. Is it 54 points?
It's 57.
Okay.
And the over-under, there is no over-under, because I'm guessing the over-under would be like 58. Right. 57 points. For instance, Alabama is hosting Mercer, and that line is only 47.
Mm-hmm. Didn't Mercer play Auburn earlier this year? That's interesting.
Yes, they did. And Auburn had 6 lost fumbles.
Okay. Wow. Good for Mercer. A little small school in Macon playing big ball.
The Citadel is plus 46 at Clemson.
Okay.
So, like, we're talking, like, this opponent is 10 points worse than those opponents as well. And, yeah. All right. That's probably it. I don't think we can top that.